Today, I'm very excited to begin my moving forward to capture my experiences as a woman along the Mormon Battalion Trail. I've struggled with this and not knowing how best to do it. Those of you who have been with me through this process have seen me try different avenues to try to share my experience, not only with just through audio, but Facebook, and then realizing that you really can't visualize all of the things that I'm talking about without the photos. So it's definitely been a process for me to try to figure out how best to consolidate all the things that I have to try to tell this story, and in a way that can capture your imagination and help you to feel some of the same feelings that I have. One of the challenges that I've had is feeling comfortable sitting in front of a microphone, just talking to a microphone. When I was talking to my sister-in-law, Sharon Green Gregory, I said, I just wish that there was somebody who could ask me questions. And she said she would do it. So today, I'm going to be able to introduce you to my delightful sister-in-law, Sharon, who has agreed to be my buddy in this project and try to help me navigate capturing it in a way that we can share it with you and that I can feel comfortable about the way we're doing it. So Sharon, thank you very much for helping me out with this.
Your introduction was lovely. Yes, my name is Sharon Green Gregory, and I know our biggest challenge today is going to be that I don't gush too much about you, Denny. You told me that this cannot happen on your podcast. I just want everyone to know, I really want to just gush about Denny and how wonderful she is and how it's an honor to do anything I can because I think she's wonderful. And I have loved getting to listen to your podcasts, and she even let me read her journal, and it was just, you know, wonderful. I'd love it to be published so everyone could read it. So I'm very excited to assist you with your podcast and ask questions. Absolutely. I know people are going to be super excited to hear about all the miracles that happened on your trek. It was, how long were you out there? About 9 months or how long?
7.5.
So many great things happened to you out there. It makes me envious. I really wish I could go back in time and just be right there by your side.
Well, it was an experience that changed my life. And as I've been preparing for these podcasts and thinking through things, I realized I have fallen back into my old ways. A lot of the things that I learned on the trek do still impact me and influence me, but it's sad in some ways that I have lapsed back into forgetting the things that I learned. So for me personally, it'll be good to review these things as well.
I feel like I can relate to that because, you know, like serving a mission for the church or being like a folk dancer, you have these experiences and then you come back and you just slip back into your old ways. You think you're better, you know. So when I got back from those experiences, I would lapse back into old habits and, you know, not be transformed as much as I wanted to be. So I can relate to that.
And one of the things I think is fun to have you visiting with me, Sharon, is you have been through a lot of different experiences. And for me, this trek was very different. I'm not adventurous. Marrying Kevin Henson transformed that. But you are much more of an adventuresome person. And so you, I think, can relate a little bit about what it's like to be in these situations that are so foreign and strange.
So I think I've had a few little adventures, but your adventure that you had way trumps anything I ever did. That, I mean, it's very, very exciting. I'm can't wait to have you share more with everybody.
I talked to Sharon and I thought, first of all, what I'd like to do is kind of give you an overview of what it might have been like for the battalion women to follow an army, because that's basically what their experience was. And so I did a little bit of research and talked to some people. And so I've asked her to help guide me through that scenario so that we can kind of have a little framework to view their experiences through.
Sounds great.
First of all, I have to let everyone know I am not a historian. If you want to get the nitty-gritty facts and the dates and the numbers, then you need to talk with the historians at the Mormon Battalion Association. They are doing incredible work, as I had mentioned before, with primary documents from the National Archives, and they're discovering a lot of things that I'm not even going to touch on because I don't have that knowledge and that expertise. I'm going to be talking about the little bit of research that I've done and my experiences, because that's really all that I can share.
And it's an amazing thing because your boots were on the ground and you were walking through that territory and seeing buffalo and all kinds of exciting things.
It's interesting that the Mormon Battalion ended up having so many women with them. Your question about why were there so many women and children with the Mormon Battalion? When the United States realized that the Mormons, as they were known, were in Iowa, Council Bluffs area, it was outside the boundaries of the United States, but they had emissaries back in Washington, D.C., trying to get President Polk to allow them to do tasks for the government to try to earn money. Of course, they'd been thrown out of their homes and their towns and communities, and they needed to support themselves wherever they decided to go. So they had asked if they could possibly build forts, if they could carry the mail. They were trying to come up with any kind of ideas, haul freight, trying to get money to try to support themselves. And I'm just learning this from Kevin now. When General Kearney was assigned to get infantry groups, all the people that he could get that wanted to volunteer for the Mexican War were people who wanted to be mounted cavalry. And he said to President Polk, you know, I am desperate. I need people to be infantry. We can go out there and try to capture California, but without infantry, I won't be able to hold it. And so the idea was brought forth to try to go and contact the Mormons out on the plains and see if they would agree to support 500 men. And in the process of that, they knew that they had quite a challenge on their hands based off of the way that the Mormons had been treated. And so President Polk wrote in his journal that he wanted to conciliate the Mormons. He wanted to do whatever he could to try to soften their opinion of the United States government and to get them to play ball nicely with him instead of possibly teaming up with Mexico or British, who were up in the northwestern part of the United States, what we call the United States now. So part of that deal was to allow women and children, families, to go with the Mormon Battalion.
Ah, so that's what sweetened the pot for the men, is knowing that their wives and children would be with them and they wouldn't have to be wondering what was going on with them in the situation where they had been kicked out of their towns and homes, and they were just in the wilderness, and they didn't want to leave them in the wilderness if they could help it. So, but not all went right. There were like 500 men, but only like 78 women and children.
You know, it wasn't a 1-to-1 ratio for sure. Every husband didn't get to take his wife, but they had the opportunity. Of course, as we said, it was an economic need, right? They needed food. And they needed a way to support themselves. And so part of the women, which is part of the well-known part of the Mormon Battalion story, is they signed up as laundresses. And when I say signed up, I am being cautioned very strongly to make sure that people don't get the impression that the women joined the Mormon Battalion. They did not. They never raised their hands. They are never shown on any muster rolls. They were more like civilian contractors that contracted the army to do the laundry.
But they still got paid, right?
Yes, they did.
And how did that happen?
It's interesting because this is another thing that I had learned back in 2008 when we started preparing to go on our trek. We actually sat down with Steve Alley, who was a historian at the Army of the West Museum there in Fort Leavenworth. And he told me the things that I've been reading and studying sync up, that the Army did not pay the laundresses. They were contracted with the Army to do laundry, but they were paid by the men. And so that's one of the interesting things that these women that are doing the research with the primary documents are finding, is that they actually have on the payroll documents that this laundress was paid X amount by this soldier. And the laundresses got paid before the soldiers did.
Okay.
So that's how they got their money. So this is kind of an interesting thing to me. Just given the tradition that the Mormon Battalion gave their money back to the church. It would be interesting to see if there's any records, whether the laundresses gave their money back after they were paid, and if any of those funds were taken back up to Brigham Young.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I bet they didn't have a lot left over. I bet the soldiers were paid quite a bit more than the laundresses were.
Well, you know what? That would be an interesting thing. I should know that. And I'll share with you, I've been reading a book. It's called Belonging to the Army. And what it was like to be a camp follower in the military. And this lady has done extensive research. If anybody wants to read this book, it really is fascinating.
I would.
She was mostly focused on the Revolutionary War. But there, I don't believe that there's been that much change since then, based off of what Steve Alley was telling me when we were speaking with him.
So the laundresses fell into the camp follower category.
Partially, yes.
Okay.
Not yes and no. So the laundress's expectations were they had to work to get any rations. And maybe this would be a good time to back up and just talk a little bit about the difference between camp followers and laundresses and things like that. So
yes.
Let me just share with you what I've been able to learn about camp followers. Camp followers, women and children have always been part of the military based on what I've been able to study. Not always something that the commanding officers are happy to deal with. And if you listened to the podcast by Jeff Wingo in Fort Leavenworth, and we asked him, you know, well, where would have the women, where would the families have camped when they got there? And, you know, what would have their life been like? And he was very straight up with us and said, hey, for a commanding officer, the mission is first. And the women are more in the way. It's just something else to contend with. And for those soldiers who don't have their wives with them, it's just a distraction and it's, you know, it just makes them feel bad. So it was interesting to hear his take on what it would be like for the women when they got to Fort Leavenworth.
So he's basically saying women were a nuisance. They weren't contributing as much as they were creating problems.
In some situations, I think that's true. I don't believe that that is the case for all of the women. And I'll read you something here. They, when you go to the Mormon Battalion website, they have the different categories of people that belonged or were affiliated with the Mormon Battalion. And they have the officers, the army officers, they have, you know, the servants, they have all kinds of things that people sometimes don't typically think of. But when I was reading this book, they were talking about camp followers and what they call retainers.
Okay, what's the difference?
So it says here in the book, it says a camp follower were people who were not officially in the army. They make no commissioning or enlistment vows. And what kept them with the army was their desire to be near loved ones, to support themselves, and or in some cases to share in the adventure.
Oh, wow.
So if we can kind of think about this in terms of the Mormon Battalion women.
Yes.
And the kinds of family constellations that they had. Some were married. All of the ones that went were married.
Oh, good, good.
Some had children, some didn't have children. Some were related to other members of the Mormon Battalion. Maybe they were their cousins or their uncles or their you know, things like that, nephews. So there were different reasons why these people went. But one of the most interesting things that I read was in the Revolutionary War, they said most of the people who were camp followers were typically women who had had the British take over their homes and businesses. They had nowhere to go.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I never thought about that before, where those people went when the British just kicked them out because they could. And that was a practical problem for the people that lost their home. Yeah.
And a very practical problem for the Mormon Battalion, right? Yeah.
And you think about 1846, it wasn't even 100 years that the Revolutionary War had happened. It had only been 70 years since that war. So they might have had some grandma and grandpas that could tell them about it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I thought that was really fascinating, given the point that why did the Mormon Battalion women sign up? They had nowhere to go.
And there was a precedent from the, you know, other wars, I guess. Yeah. So that's what you do. You stay with your loved ones and try and find your way forward. So I still don't understand what retainers are, and are they people that get paid? I mean, what's the difference again?
Yeah, I think that's the big difference from the retainers. And it says the retainers followed the army because of personal inclination, pleasure, or, and I think this is where a lot of the Mormon Battalion women come in, the possibility of provisions and paying positions.
Okay. So they're kind of like waiting for that opportunity, and they'd be there and be able to make some money. Or
that's one of the things that I learned, was if you were going to get any kind of rations, and that was one of the things that George Washington was very adamant about. Look, we know that you want your wives and your families here, but if they are going to be here, they need to contribute. Oh, and some of those women, we're there for patriotic reasons as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how the Mormon Battalion women felt about being patriotic at that point.
Right.
The British, of course, they took over homes of the American revolutionaries, but the Mormons had their homes taken over, not by a foreign government. So right. I'm not sure how they felt about being patriotic. I think they were more in line with trying to follow the prophet at that point.
And in a way, England probably felt foreign to them, but it was their motherland, right? So it wasn't exactly like Germany was invading. It was like the mother was invading. Probably really, really hurt. So that is interesting to think about.
An interesting juxtaposition. And I guess another thing that I need to help people understand that I didn't realize was, of course, they had the big call to enlist. So everybody was asked to enlist, but not all of those women knew that they were going to go on the Mormon Battalion at that point. Okay. It wasn't until some of the husbands got down to Fort Leavenworth, and on the way to Fort Leavenworth, they saw some of the other officers had their families with them, and they said, hey, how does this work? And they said, well, yeah, if you're an officer and you have your own supplies and your own wagon, then you can have your family. And so there were some women that actually got the word sent back up to Council Bluffs and said, come and meet me in Fort Leavenworth.
And how far would that have been? What kind of a trip would that be for a woman to make?
I think it's about 150 miles.
Oh, that's a serious distance when you don't have a car, right?
That's a week. Plus you've got to bring all, not just your wagon. You got to bring your animals.
Oh, wow.
So, and you know, it's interesting to see how quickly these people responded. Like one man went to the very last meeting the night before they left. And he felt impressed that he should sign up. So the very next morning he was gone. It wasn't like he had a lot of time to prepare.
Wow.
But I do want to back up just one more second to the camp followers. One of the reasons was to share in the adventure. And I honestly believe that there had to be some women that wanted the adventure, because that's why, right?
Yes. So like when you study the women that went, is there somebody that comes to mind when you talk about the one that was there for the adventure? Is there a name that comes to your mind?
For me, it's Melissa Corray, because she was young. She had just been married. And, you know, who wants to sit at home in the cold winter when you can be out and about with your husband?
I have to tell you, I watched like a little overview of the Mormon Battalion, and I understand that there was like a peak named after her. Is that correct?
That's right. Very, very famous.
Fascinating. So I have like a picture that I took of her, so if we want to include that, then everyone can know what she looks like and what the peak looks like.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that would be fun.
I know that there is going to be just another sneak peek. I've been trying to tell people about this, but it's taking longer than I expected. So I don't want you to lose interest, but they are making and doing stories about each of the five women who made it all the way to California.
So oh, that wonderful.
Is going to be coming, I guess, now next March.
Or and when you say spring. They, is that the Mormon Battalion Association?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Good for them. Fantastic. So, yes. But I know from your journal that the one you thought about the most was the wife of Ebenezer.
Phoebe Draper Palmer Brown.
Wow, what a fun name. Oh, I love those little times in your journal when you would reflect on an experience you were having, whether it was doing the laundry or trying to cook or trying to cross a river, and how you would think about how that would have been for Phoebe.
She was much more prevalent in my mind because she was closer to my age.
Interesting.
And, we had been reenacting her and her husband here in the River of Time living history event that we did here. So I knew a little bit more about her. But once again, I am not a historian. That is not where I get my jollies. Yes. I love to do other things. But Phoebe was an amazing person. And one of the podcasts I'm going to be doing shortly when we get to Tucson, you're going to learn a lot more about Phoebe and Ebenezer.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
We're talking to one of her descendants.
Fantastic. You have these vocabulary words. Like, you had the word entourage, and I wasn't sure. I'm not a French person. I was like, I don't even know how to say that word, so I'm hoping she says that word.
Oh, and that's good. Thank you for asking that. Gosh, we do need to define that. So, first of all, the word entourage, the Mormon Battalion Association, they have created this word called the entourage because they didn't quite know how to define all of these people that were camp followers and retainers, if you will. And so they came upon the word to use entourage. It's a group of people that are following another group. So
okay.
It pretty well covers everybody. But anyway, that's what entourage is.
And the other word I had to look up from the note you gave me was settlers. I thought, is that like the way Oklahomans say settlers? Settlers, I've never heard that word before. So I had to look it up, and it's a real word.
It is, yep. And those are the people that contracted with the Army. Once again, they were not in the Army, but many of them were licensed and contracted with the Army to provide supplies for the troops that were on campaigns. And it was interesting, apparently the prices are set with the Army. So the settlers are not allowed to gouge the people that they're selling supplies to. And the settlers came into play for me in preparing for this episode because I thought, well, okay, so what about these women that are not laundresses, they're not drawing rations? If they do get any money from anything that they do, would they be able to go to these settlers and buy things that they wanted? So I don't know. That would be an interesting thing to see what kind of interactions the battalion women had with the settlers that were following the Army.
Yes. I love the stories. I mean, when you can bring those stories from the men, mostly men, right? But a few from the women about what their experiences were like. And you were saying that if people have more questions, they can always volunteer, right? Information. And can you explain that? The one question was, what about those who went to Pueblo? Because the goal wasn't to get to Pueblo, but some had to go to Pueblo.
When the Mormon Battalion women and families agreed to go, when the battalion members signed up with the understanding that their families would stay with them through the march to California, that was what they contracted for. And as things and circumstances changed, the new commander who had been where they were supposed to go realized what that would have done to these women and children. It was a huge blessing that the Army decided to detach or to separate these families from the main body of the Mormon Battalion and send them up to Pueblo.
Okay.
And so that's the word detachment. Anything that there were three groups that were detached from the main body of the Mormon Battalion and were sent up to Pueblo. And that in and of itself is a miracle.
Did you say it was five that made it to San Diego, or was it less than that?
It was five. Colonel Cook allowed five to travel on with their husbands who were officers. And that's one of the other interesting things that's happened just this past year with the documents that they found and the super sleuth putting the puzzle pieces together. these women have been able to positively identify who the fifth woman was who met in California. And that has not been known. Hoping that we can have them come and talk about how all of the little pieces fit together and how they finally determined who that was.
They sleuthed out the answer. And so you can have like a link on this one with that little, so they can go figure it out. Because I want to know.
I'm going to have her talk to us.
Okay, another.
Who it was.
Yeah. Fabulous. All right. Sounds exciting. And what kind of rations did they have for the women and the men? It was pretty scanty, wasn't it? It wasn't that great.
The Mormon Battalion had a struggle, one, because they originally set out from Fort Leavenworth with the instructions to go to Bent's Fort, which was a northern mountain route. And when they got to a certain place, they were told, never mind, don't go to Bent's Fort. We want you to take the southern route, the Cimarron cutoff, and go south to Santa Fe that way. So what did that do for their rations? All their rations had been sent to Bent's Fort.
Oh, that's why they were suffering during that phase. Oh, goodness.
Yeah. So they did not have probably the full complement of what they thought they were supposed to get, or at least they thought they were going to get to Bent's Fort and then replenish. And that's not what happened. Mm-hmm. So as terms of what kind of rations they got, that's an interesting question.
I think the reason I think about that is because when I was an Air Force brat in Germany, we had a Girl Scout troop that was asked to go to the unknown soldier in France, where they have that tomb, and to lay a wreath on the tomb. And so that was like a whole weekend trip. And the way they fed us was they gave us K rations from World War II kind of time frame. So we had like Hershey bars, and you know, you could pull open these tins and have little crackers and meat. And it was, I thought, this is so interesting to be eating the food that these soldiers that died in France would have been eating.
Oh, wow. What a nice way to give you that kind of context, right?
But totally different, right? I mean, I'm sure the rations they had were more like, I don't know, succotash or something. Not Hershey bars.
Well, actually, talking about this, this reminds me, we did do a lot of research on what their rations were, because we wanted to make sure that we had the authentic stuff when people came to hike with us. And that is where I gained my true appreciation of how awful salt pork must have been.
Oh my goodness.
And how they preserved their meat, and hardtack, just really unappetizing in my book.
Yes. And it probably is only appetizing if you're nigh unto death, you know, and you're starving. And then it's delicious, right? I don't know if Sherry Lynn ever told you the story when she went on the Pioneer Trek as a youth, and she said the ash cakes were so delicious on the Pioneer Trek. And so after that, she tried to recreate the ash cake, and she realized it would only taste delicious again if she'd been starved for the last 2 days. And then at that point in time, an ash cake would be delicious. So
that's my experience with chicken broth.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you're on that Pioneer Trek and handcart trek, oh, that first night, it just is heavenly.
Yes.
And I thought, you know what? That was so good. I'll just make some at home.
Not good.
Not so much.
Not unless you've had a hard day, right? And then everything's magical. It's like, what a blessing for those people as they were suffering across in such difficult situations to have their brain trick themselves into thinking they were really getting a treat. Succotash.
Yes.
No, I seriously want your succotash recipe. You made that sound good, Denny.
It is good, actually.
Okay.
And like I said, I did find the recipe, so I'll have to put it up on Facebook or something.
All right.
You know, one of the things I think that's also interesting for the women to realize, these were farmers' wives. You know, they'd been living in a beautiful place, right? Nauvoo was just beautiful.
Right.
They had nice homes. They had gardens. They loved flowers. And all of a sudden, they are thrown into this environment with the army, where there is a lot of, as Jeff Wingo said, alcoholism was a very big problem in the army.
Wow.
So here they are with their children in this environment that is less than desirable. And last night, Marianne Kirk gave a a presentation in the Mormon Battalion Association's general membership meeting where she talked about Pueblo and how the women of the Mormon Battalion were afraid of the environment that they were in because of all the trappers and the traders, and how they kept trying to woo their young daughters and their teenage
daughters. Oh, no.
They were so glad when the Mormon Battalion men arrived to kind of bolster their numbers. But you got to think that here are these women that are used to living in this culture, refined, so to speak, environment. And then all of a sudden, there they are out on the Wild West frontier with a bunch of Yehus.
Whoa, what a culture shock.
You asked about the laundresses, and mm-hmm. one of the things that Chief Alley told me when we were studying them back in 2008, he said that laundresses at that point were not looked upon favorably. Most of them were single women who didn't have an education. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was the case with the Mormon Battalion. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, Kevin gave me a journal entry Dr. Sanderson wrote. One of his friends talked to him about the Mormon Battalion women. He said, "I noticed his extreme politeness to the Mormon ladies on several mm-hmm. occasions." This was actually in Council Grove, where he met up with one of his buddies from Mississippi who was talking about the Mormon women. But there were other things that people had mentioned about the women and how impressed they were with them and their demeanor.
Oh, well, that's lovely. It kind of reminds me of like when you watch My Fair Lady and the flower girl says, "I'm always going to act like a flower girl because you always treat me like a flower girl," you know? And I have a feeling those women, they knew how to conduct themselves. That kind of inspired the men around them to be, you know, better for it. So that's beautiful. You have talked about the difficulty being on the trail. And can we tie that into this a little bit? Like what it was like for you to have to do laundry by hand because you weren't able to bring a washer and dryer with you on your trek across the country. Can you explain to people how hard that is on your body to do laundry by hand?
I can't attest to the exact experience because I never had to haul water and I didn't have to heat it up on a fire. Uh-huh. But doing laundry by hand, and for any of those who have done it, you know that it's a different experience. But mm-hmm. my laundry experience was I used my own soap. Oh, laundresses wow. could charge more if they use their own soap.
Interesting.
Than if the men provided it. I never got paid for doing laundry.
That's terrible, Denny.
As I was preparing for this, I thought, I've missed the boat.
Uh-huh. You could have really
kept earning my keep.
Absolutely.
I think the most thing I washed for other people were socks.
Okay.
And for Kevin, that's where I learned how hard it was to wring out clothes by hand. And when you've got a pair of pants or a shirt, shirts weren't as bad because they were thin and they would wad up pretty well when you tried to wring them. But those pants, those were miserable and they never, ever would get dry.
Oh my goodness.
Especially in Missouri. In Iowa, when we would try to do that, it was the next morning I'd hang them up and I'd, you know, I'd try to do laundry first thing when they stopped. So we would have the maximum amount of time to let it dry, but it just never seemed to ever get enough.
If there's something about putting on damp clothing that can be very hard on the spirits, right? It's just, it's so depressing to get up knowing you're going to have to put on wet socks, wet pants. But then during the day, it would dry out, right? They would sweat on it probably, but you know, at some point maybe it would dry out before they got sweaty again.
Some of my most spiritual and pioneerish moments were doing laundry.
Because you'd have these thoughts as you worked with the soap and the water and what kind of thoughts?
Well, one of the things that I came to really appreciate was, okay, these women had a tough go, right? But they saw so many beautiful things. And there were several places that I did laundry that were just spectacularly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing laundry, I was looking at these beautiful vistas.
Oh, wow.
And one of those was at Faye Gaines house at Point of Rocks. And I was just out on this dirt road driveway up to her house. And she had a spigot in one of the buildings that was out by a split rail fence. And I just did the laundry and spent the morning out there just loving every minute of it and hanging the clothes out on this fence and the bushes and trying to get them dry. And I could have done that all day.
Oh, wow.
Because it just was a really sweet experience for me.
Beautiful. And when you use the word thicket, that is like bushes, little trees, because you, at that point, you were in a, like more of a savanna, more of a grassland. Were there trees?
No. Out in New Mexico, like they call it the high desert.
Mm-hmm.
But no, not a lot of anything. When you're there, you begin to see the beauty that's all around you. But yeah, she just had like fences around her ranch, and I would just hang up the laundry on those. Sometimes, yes. If there was bushes, we would hang them on bushes.
Uh-huh. And I think I listened to that podcast, and you basically described her place as the Garden of Eden, and she'd lived there for 70 years as a married woman, and right, that's about,
yeah.
I love that story. That was really interesting. I hope everyone gets to listen to that one too. There's so many wonderful podcasts. I think I've listened to almost 30 of yours, and I just enjoy them so much.